Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, most of our listeners are in Florida, and many of those listeners who are not live in Tennessee and North Carolina and Virginia and elsewhere, in some cases around the world, and many of those people have been to Florida. So the beaches are obviously a popular destination. But next to its beaches, probably the most prominent geographic feature along Florida's east coast is a 156-mile-long estuary called the Indian River Lagoon. So that's its official name. But those of us like me who grew up along it and have lived on its banks or fish and boat on it usually call it the Indian River. There's a channel that runs down the middle of the Indian River for all of its length, and that makes it an important segment of what boaters know as the Intracoastal Waterway, which stretches from Norfolk, Virginia to Miami. So this body of water has many names. It's a long, skinny estuary, and it's many things to many different people. But above all, it's a tremendously diverse natural environment. And like many bodies of water these days, its health is in serious peril. And that's what we're going to talk about during the show today. My guests today are Drs. Robert Weaver and John Treffrey. They're both with the Indian River Lagoon Research Institute, which was recently established at the Florida Institute of Technology in Melbourne, Florida. The radio station at which is one of the stations that American Variety's aired on, by the way. And the Research Institute has the mission to develop solutions for revitalizing the Indian River Lagoon and keeping it healthy. Robert is one of the institution's directors, and John is one of its scientists. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
First, Robert, let me ask you, why is the Indian River called a lagoon? I think we tend to think of that word as meaning like small islands in the South Pacific with a round kind of lake-like feature in the middle that's a lagoon. So why is this long, skinny one called a lagoon?
Well, thank you, Court. First, I'd like to take this moment to thank you for the opportunity to share our experiences with you and your audience, which I'm a listening member as well. And as you know from growing up here, this is really, truly, the Indian River Lagoon is truly a treasure of the treasure and space coast here on Florida's East Coast. Despite the name, the Indian River is not truly a river. There's no real flow in the Indian River other than the tidally driven or wind-driven flows. So the Indian River itself fits the definition of a lagoon, which is a shallow body of water that's adjacent to or surrounded by a larger body of water. In our case, we have this microtidal lagoon in the north, and in the south we've got some inlets connecting to the ocean. And so that's really what makes it a lagoon. There are a few freshwater rivers that feed in and tributaries that flow into the lagoon, and that's what makes it an estuary.
For those who don't know, what is an estuary?
So an estuary, it's a special class of lagoon where we have that freshwater inflow mixing with the salt water from the sea, and that's really what makes it an estuary, a very diverse habitat.
So there is some flow in and out, but there are just some inlets that are kind of artificially cut through or at least enhanced by human action here and there along the length of the lagoon that gives it some inflow and outflow from the ocean, but not much, right? Is that the idea?
That's correct. The inlets themselves, there are five that are connected to the ocean. Two of those five are natural inlets, and the others are were man-made, and they're all managed now. And so as the tide comes in and goes out, there's a bit of a flow that's induced tidally. But there's no mean or net flow down the Indian River Lagoon as one would expect if it were truly a river.
Yeah, so I think the core of this show is going to be the problems that are caused by the fact that there's not a lot of circulation. It's not a river where it's continually dumping itself out and it's not being refreshed much. So I think that FIT, Florida Institute of Technology, and scientists from other places have researched the problems in the lagoon for years. Why did FIT decide to establish the Indian River Lagoon Research Institute?
The institute was formed as a response to the recent declining health of the Indian River Lagoon. As you mentioned, folks have been researching this body of water for years, and for recent years, the health in the lagoon was thought to be improving. But then a few years ago, back in 2011, there was a very large algal bloom, been called the super bloom. And that really set a lot of folks back on their heels. And so, you know, when I came down here to Florida Institute of Technology in 2011, and so I came down in the midst of this crisis. We wanted to get the researchers at FIT who had experience working in and on the lagoon kind of all together for regular brown bag lunch meetings where we could discuss the science and the engineering and possible solutions that could help us deal with this recent crisis and look at the larger overall issues of why something that seemed to be rebounding quickly turned. What I realized very quickly is with over 20 faculty researchers that were participating and years of experience ranging from my short time of just a few years being down here to other faculties having been working and researching here for 30 years, we quickly realized that we needed a more organized approach to this problem. And that's when we got together and really formalized this collaborative that is the Indian River Lagoon Research Institute.
I'm going to guess that another factor is that a lot of the scientists had been looking at the lagoon and its problems from through the telescope or the perspective of their own specific specialized disciplines, and an institute maybe gives you a way to bring an interdisciplinary approach to it where a whole bunch of people's perspectives are kind of mixed into the same bowl and you can get a big picture of it. Is that valid?
That's absolutely valid. And we've, you know, through the institute and the recent formation, we already have several faculty members from different departments across campus have been submitting grants and been awarded funded research, you know, where we have biologists and engineers working together and meteorologists and oceanographers and engineers working together. So it really is kind of, just as you mentioned, bringing folks from different disciplines together.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. John Weaver and Dr. John Treffery. They're both with the Indian River Lagoon Research Institute, which is at the Florida Institute of Technology in Melbourne, Florida. As its name implies, it looks at the health of the Indian River Lagoon, which is a very long body of water on Florida's east coast. So, John Treffery, what exactly is wrong with the health of the lagoon? Must be a bunch of things at once. Kind of walk through all of that.
So the immediate problem that's garnered national attention is really linked to these massive superblooms of algae that we had beginning in 2011. And as expected, they blocked sunlight and led to massive declines in seagrass. In fact, estimates for the Northern Lagoon are that we lost 60% of our seagrass. And with this came deaths of manatees, bottlenose dolphins, and pelicans. So that was the more immediate thing that has really risen to the top. But if you step back a bit, the problem really is that we've been discharging a lot of waste into the lagoon for more than 50 years. These wastes include stormwater runoff, soil because we haven't practiced good soil conservation, nutrients from fertilizer and septic tanks. And so we've had this problem that has just been festering for years and years and years, and a variety of things sort of created a superstorm, perfect storm that we see today. One of the things that I work on is muck, and muck is one of the products of all of the waste that have gone into the lagoon. It takes on the characteristic of a black mayonnaise, and indeed at the heart of all this are nutrients are our problem. We just have too much nitrogen and phosphorus to spur all this algae growth.
Yes, I know from having lived for many years on the banks of the Indian River, as I mentioned, that every time there's a storm, speaking of storms, and especially a tropical storm or a hurricane that dumps, you know, 10 to 15 inches of rain in the middle of the state, that the Corps of Engineers has canals that were put there originally to drain the Everglades, and so they open up the locks in those canals and they drain the excess water out of the middle of the state, and the part that goes from the middle of the state east ends up in the lagoon, and it's a sudden influx of fresh water into this basically brackish body of water, and it changes the salinity drastically. And I've seen that, you know, many times as a huge change, and that causes these algae blooms too, and different kinds of things occur. I don't even know what they are. I mean, suddenly the river will get bioluminescent. It can't be healthy, you know, so that's probably another big one too, right?
Yes, so that is the question. Why now something so large? What changed? And we went through a period of drought around the late 90s, early 2000s, and that brought in less nutrients, and that's what led to this sort of, wow, we're doing okay, the lagoon's pretty good. And then the 2004 hurricanes really threw a twist at us. They brought in a lot of fresh water, a lot of new organic matter and soil to create these muck deposits, and they spread muck all over the lagoon. And so the things that I'm following up on is that this muck is really an important source of nitrogen and phosphorus that comes, that is released from the muck and comes back into the water and really fuels these algae blooms. And so the hurricanes increase the surface area where we found muck. So in turn then, over the few years that have followed since then, we're having this internal cycling of nutrients that I think is an important part of the super bloom.
Yeah, and I guess there can be a lag effect on that. After the salinity drops and stuff comes in and muck forms, then and muck ends up releasing its nutrients back in an unhealthy way into the water. Can seagrasses grow in muck? I mean, I know what it is. I've seen it. It's like, as you say, like brown mayonnaise, it's like stepping in quicksand. It'll suck your shoes off, you know, and it's deep sometimes. Can anything grow in that stuff?
No, there's no seagrass. There's very little life in it. It's sort of a haven for bacteria.
That's good. Huge haven. Well, so you mentioned a die-off of manatees and dolphins, and those are some of the more charismatic large mammals that that people are aware of that live in the Indian River Lagoon, but there are thousands of species that live there. What are some of the other marine animals that live in the lagoon that are important to its health and its natural state?
Well, certainly my neighbors would like to cheer for the snook, yeah, and the sea bass and some of the fish, because certainly fishing has been a real important activity in the lagoon. So I think you could list a variety of fish. But then you go on to the blue crab, and other organisms like that, and you just find, as you say, it's just an incredible list of flora and fauna.
When I was a kid growing up in Fort Pierce, Florida, about halfway down the lagoon on its east coast, we would go out. I mean, we're talking, you know, I'm ancient, so we were talking mid-60s here. And if we were going to have a party, a bunch of kids, you know, in somebody's backyard, we would go over that afternoon literally with garbage cans stuck into truck inner tubes and with the handle tied to our waist, and we'd walk out in certain places, you know, waist deep, and you could reach down and just in 10 minutes, you could fill up the garbage can with oysters as big as your hand, you know, big clumps of them, and then take them back and spend the afternoon opening them and drinking Coke or beer if your parents were gone. And that, I suspect, is a pleasurable pastime that is probably nearly extinct, huh?
It sure is. I know I used to walk around with my toes and feel in the sand for clams, and it was so easy to get the clams and really get large clams pretty quickly. I recently did a survey of over 30 miles of the lagoon with a professional clammer, and we found no clams. The oyster is no better off, even though folks now are working hard to try and put some oyster mats out there. But yeah, the oysters and the clams have really been one of the sad stories of the lagoon, their decline.
All right, so what actually does happen to the marine life, the fish, the oysters, the clams, the larger mammals? I mean, do they just die en masse, or do they get sick? Do they move away? I mean, you know, what overall happens to them?
Yeah, so this is a tough question that still people are searching for answers on. But if you start with the seagrass die-off, once you start to have seagrass die-off, then you've taken away food for the manatee. Hmm. So the manatee nutrition suffers and all the things that go with that. At the same time, you take away the seagrass, you've taken away habitat for the fish. So it becomes a ripple effect. And the seagrass is really the core, the heart of the system. And when you remove that, the effect is just a domino effect.
Do you guys date the decline of the river to any particular period of time, or is it just kind of amorphous?
Well, I actually age date sediments, and I find that I can't find muck sediments before 1950. I look at it more not so much as storms, but this continual input of waste products, grass cutting, soil that has been going on for 5 or 6 decades. And maybe we're now at that tipping, but we're definitely at that tipping point now.
Are there parts of this long lagoon that are in better shape than others, John?
Oh, a few years ago, I would have said yes, but I'm not so certain today. Up in our part of the lagoon, we have about a 90-mile stretch that goes from south of Daytona Beach all the way to Sebastian Inlet, where there are no inlets. Hmm. And so soil and runoff that comes in there stays there. And so this area has been especially hard hit. And we generally thought that our fellows to the south, where there were more inlets, were better off. However, as you probably well know, as you move south there, they've been recently plagued by water inputs from Lake Okeechobee and a variety of other issues.
So even near the inlets, which used to be more pristine looking, I mean, it looked more like the Bahamas. You know, the water was more turquoise, there was more grass, there were more fish. You know, you could see schools of mullet jumping. But even in those areas close to the inlets, now it's getting the illness is approaching those areas too.
They certainly have degraded over the past 10 to 20 years. They're still better than if you go in some of the more secluded areas, say around Cocoa or Rockledge. They have diminished, but not relative to the upland areas that are really in bad shape.
Well, you're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking about the shape of the Indian River Lagoon and its health on the east coast of Florida. We're talking with Dr. John Treffery, who's a scientist with the Indian River Lagoon Research Institute in Melbourne, Florida, and Dr. Robert Weaver, who's one of its directors. And John, we're going to stick with you for just a minute. I know you're both scientists, but let me just continue with you for a minute. In a nutshell, if you can do such a thing, what are the biggest scientific challenges facing researchers who are doing what you guys are trying to do, which is to improve the health of the lagoon and understand its problems?
Well, I think the scientific challenges have actually lapsed over into being engineering and management challenges. That what we really understand is that we are adding all of these waste products into the lagoon, and we need a course of action to diminish those inputs and then to remove what's there. So we are working very hard to try to get funding for the engineering and management solutions. Scientifically, the one thing I'd have to pick on is that we really don't have enough data to show the magnitude of inputs of these various products. We just haven't done a good job of keeping track of that. And we really are just beginning to measure the internal recycling of the nitrogen and phosphorus that spur these blooms.
Robert Weaver, what other scientific organizations and groups are contributing to this work? I know that the Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute in Fort Pierce has been around for quite a while, and they do a good amount of work in this field too. What around Florida and elsewhere, what other organizations do you partner with and who also contribute to this research?
Well, Court, luckily this is a fairly large group, a fairly long list, and maybe John can help me is make sure we don't leave too many people out. You know, definitely the state of Florida, and as well as the national agencies, Florida DEP, the National Estuary Program, that's the EPA, NOAA, is funding research in the lagoon. We have Florida has the water management districts. And so on the lagoon, that's the St. Johns River Water Management District in the north, and in the south end, it's the South Florida Water Management District. The counties themselves are doing quite a bit, as are the cities, in contributing to this problem. Really, I think everyone has really started to come together, recognizing this as a problem that's going to take is all hands on deck. You mentioned universities and research centers. There's our university, of course, Florida Atlantic, Harbor Branch, University of Florida, University of Central Florida are all doing research out here. John, am I leaving anyone out?
Well, I think the NGOs have been important, too. We have a group called the Marine Resources Council here in the Melbourne area, and the Florida Oceanographic Society has been great, too. We really do have a good wealth of talent and people here. We just got to get it all working together.
Well, Robert, this is obviously a problem with a lot of branches to it. A lot of things contribute to making this a massive, intractable, long-term problem in a very big body of water. Tell us what can be done to improve the situation. I mean, there must be a lot of different things that have to be done in different areas to fix different parts of the problem.
Absolutely. And if you take the broad view, kind of looking down, you know, the answer would be, you know, we got to really manage the growth, manage development, and reduce the pollutants that are coming into the lagoon, as well as addressing, especially in the north end where we don't have the flushing, addressing what's been put in the lagoon over the past 5 or 6 decades. So then the question is, how do we go about doing that? And there's a lot of many different actions that can be taken, and I'll hit on a few. One is, many counties and municipalities along the lagoon either have passed or are considering fertilizer ordinances that are stronger than state regulations. And so supporting those is important, and getting those passed is important. And some of those include the regulating the type of fertilizer, using a majority of slow-release nitrogen as opposed to the quick-release. One method that I'm very firm on believing we need to approach is by re-strengthening the natural buffers of the system. And by that, I mean restoring the natural kidneys and livers of the lagoon. That's a critical step, and that's putting those oysters that you used to collect and the clams that John used to collect, mussels, getting those back in the lagoon and getting those populations back, because those are the filter feeders, and they're really do a lot of work to help keeping that water clean and maintaining the resiliency of the system. But in addition to the animals, you know, the low marsh habitat, as well as the mangrove and the marsh grass fringe, that also plays a large role in keeping that system resilient. Septic tanks are a big problem, primarily those that are built prior to 1980s. So, you know, having septic tank inspections for those tanks, those older tanks, you know, that's one route that can be taken. And then being able to provide, you know, having the state or the local governments be able to provide some financial assistance for retrofitting failing septic systems could also play a large role. And then there's John has talked about the muck and dealing with that legacy load that's been put in. That definitely needs to be addressed, and that is starting to be addressed here in Brevard County with some financial help from the state. And we're also looking into innovative methods for removing nutrients out of the lagoon and locations where there are elevated nutrient hotspots. And then kind of on the tail end, the large-scale solutions, and one that shouldn't be discounted as offhand, is the idea of increasing flushing in the northern portion of the lagoon in a manageable way. There's 90 miles between the two ocean-connected inlets for the northern portion of the lagoon. And if we can develop a manageable system that can control some flow coming from the ocean into the lagoon, we will be able to develop a bit of flushing up here that I think could really help things out.
How would you do that last thing?
Well, I think modifying existing infrastructure is probably one of the easiest ways. We're doing research here in my lab on the benefits of a low-crested weir being put in to allow the flood tide to pump into the lagoon. And that actually seems, studies are showing that would generate a bit of a southerly current in the lagoon there. And so there are ways out there that we can look into and see if they can be done, but I don't think an inlet is really the way to go. I think that's too expensive on the upfront costs and too expensive in management and maintenance costs.
So I gather that getting salt water in is one thing and keeping some fresh water out is another. Are you able to make any headway with working with like the Corps of Engineers to reduce or stretch out or somehow ameliorate the effect of the gigantic flood of fresh water that comes into the lagoon after big storms?
So this is a huge problem for the southern portion of the lagoon, and there is a lot of minds coming together to try and figure out how to solve that problem. And that problem isn't a coastal problem. You know, the water that's coming from the canals from Lake Okeechobee, well, it's coming down the Kissimmee River from central Florida into Lake Okeechobee. So this is really it's a statewide problem, and there have been some developments for dealing with the Kissimmee River, adding back in oxbows that were removed when it was initially channelized to drain the central portion of the state. And a lot of land is being purchased or attempted to be purchased south of the lake to try and restore that southerly flow that was the river of grass. Of water flowing from Lake Okeechobee south down through the Everglades into Florida Bay.
Mm-hmm.
There are management policies that can help reduce the effects of very large and long-term freshwater releases, and the Corps is looking at that from what I understand. I was just at a meeting a couple of days ago of the Florida Lake Management Society, and there was a lot of talk on how that's being addressed. Folks are looking into that as well.
Has anybody made any kind of off-the-cuff or ballpark estimates of overall how much effective solutions will cost? I mean, I don't mean a complicated answer here, but, you know, and it may be that the answer is no, because maybe it's a foolish thing to try to do and scare legislators off or whatever. But, I mean, are we talking several billion dollars or in order of magnitude? Any idea on that?
We're talking hundreds of millions to billion to about $1 billion, I think, is you know that's where we are. You know, some of the solutions are free and don't cost anything. I mean, you could regulate fertilizer usage, which many folks are doing now, municipalities and counties, emissions to the atmosphere. You can incentivize septic conversion. So a lot of those things that can be done are relatively free. But once you start getting into these stormwater management projects, large-scale dredging, that gets very expensive. And we're looking at just for dredging. If you're dredging the muck out of the lagoon, is at least $100 million to get that done correctly. Implementing all of these solutions together makes it a very large number, yes.
You know, so given all that, Robert, what is the realistic outlook for turning the river around, to getting it back to some degree of health where it's sustainable into the future and doesn't turn into just a big stagnant bathtub? I mean, you know, it sounds like I'm asking for a pessimistic answer, but, you know, realistically, what do you think?
Well, you know, realistically, I think we can be optimistic. We can be optimistic, but not unrealistic. Population and the associated development is going to continue to expand. But with all new development now, we have regulations on how that development can occur. So reducing the amount of soils coming in and the amount of runoff from any given development. So that's good. Moving into the future, there's retrofitting that would need to be done for the older developments, but I think, you know, it's those pressures from unchecked growth from the older developments is what got us into this mess. And if we can keep the public support and keep the public and the elected officials focused on the issue, I think we will see the system rebound. Now, how fast it will rebound is another matter. You know, it depends on how quickly we can get some of these solutions implemented. And then as you said, you know, and stay that way. Well, we have to design that resiliency into the system. So, you know, maybe a managed solution for some of these things is the way to go.
Well, Drs. Weaver and Treffery, we are out of time. But, you know, I think the key to it is people being aware of these problems and what they can do about it. And then they can learn more about that by going to a couple of websites, and many of them probably, but I'll read you a couple. Research.fit, Florida Institute of Technology, .edu. /IRLRI, which is the acronym for the Research Institute, research.fit.edu/IRLRI, and also It's Your Lagoon, one word, itsyourlagoon.com. Dr. Weaver and Dr. Treffery, I want to thank you so much for being on with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks to all of you for listening, and I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.